Our first case this morning is Kane versus Siemens Corporation, number 25-2564. And we'll start with Mr. Polenko.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Kai Polenko for Plaintiff Appellant Jim Kane. May I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Sure.
Thank you. ERISA requires fiduciaries to administer a plan in the best interest of participants. That's a benefit that is promised by the statute itself. And that benefit is a term of every ERISA plan, regardless of whether the plan expressly says so. And it is that benefit, the promise to administer the plan solely in the interest of participants, that plaintiff has plausibly alleged Siemens failed to provide participants here while administering the plan's forfeitures provision. Everyone agrees that forfeitures are plan assets. As such, Siemens was necessarily acting as a fiduciary when it exercised control over their management and disposition.
Does Siemens have an obligation to provide the benefit in the first place?
No, that's a settler function. That's a settler function. And when they could write the plan how they want to write it. But the way this plan is written, it entrusted Siemens as a fiduciary to decide what to do with plan assets.
Over the plan assets, right. Which, so could you explain the terms of the agreement, if there's forfeiture and how that works?
Yeah, the participants will contribute a portion of their salary to the plan, and the company has a matching contribution obligation. And in order to vest in that matching contribution, the participants have to work a certain number of years. And if they don't, then they forfeit that matching contribution and the money needs to be reallocated toward another use. The issue here is the plan sets it up in such a way, it's designed in such a way that the fiduciary has to decide who saves money. We have this bucket of money.
But I think isn't the question, I guess, is at the time of the forfeiture, though, don't those assets that don't vest actually cease to be part of the benefit that was promised? So therefore, maybe they're no longer subject to the same fiduciary requirements as previously.
I don't think that's quite right, because they're plan assets once they're contributed to the plan. The forfeitures always remain plan assets. I think we all agree that they're plan assets. The issue is, what does the forfeitures provision promise? It promises, you know, because ERISA requires fiduciaries to administer a plan in the best interest of participants, it requires that the forfeitures will be reallocated to the best use for participants. That's the promise. And so what we're alleging here is that Siemens did not act in the best interest of participants.
But those folks are no longer participants at that point because they've left before the vesting.
But the forfeitures are reallocated toward offsetting the expenses of the remaining participants or reducing the contributions that Siemens has to make for the remaining participants or the future participants. So the fact that the individuals who left and forfeit their matching contribution are no longer participants is not the issue. The money remains plan assets, and that has to be reallocated toward either the contribution obligation or the defraying the expenses of the existing participants.
I guess the question that I understand this case to be about, right, is whose benefit, like, is there the same kind of requirement, the same kind of fiduciary relationship with that unvested money once it's forfeited? Because that's your whole argument, right?
Yeah, and I think it is, of course, because it's a plan asset. Once it's a plan asset, it doesn't cease to become a plan asset once it's forfeited. It always is a plan asset. And the fiduciary duties attached to any person who exercises control over the management or disposition of plan assets.
But if the,
one question I have is, when I read the plan, and I think that's what we're supposed to read, it says that you know, one of the uses is to offset administrative costs. And you're claiming that's the use that should have been done. Just if that, your case goes away. If the plan didn't allow that, if it just said, no, we're never going to use this forfeited money to offset administrative costs. Just no, that's silliness. Why would we do that? We don't want to do that. You don't have a case in that instance, right? It all hinges on the allowance of administrative costs as an option, right?
Yeah, Siemens could design the plan differently. It designed the plan in this way, which it trusts a fiduciary to decide what to do with this bucket of plan money. But it could design the plan differently and say, We're not going to allow that as an option. As a settlor, we're going to say that all forfeitures must be used to offset company contributions. They could lawfully do that.
And in fact, there's certain regulations in the code of regulations that says some trusts can never even do this. Now, there's a revenue ruling that exempts, I guess, certain entities from following that regulation. But if I'm recalling right, there's 26 CFR 1-4017A that basically just says, yeah, the plan must expressly provide that forfeitures arising from severance of employment, death, or for any other reason must not be applied to increase benefits any employee would otherwise receive under the plan. But
that's a regulation that applies to a different kind of plan, plus to my understanding of defined benefit plans. There is a proposed regulation that would allow using forfeitures to offset contributions, but that's a design issue. The tax laws are concerned with plan design, not fiduciary decision making. And so all the tax laws allow is that, you know, you could design a plan to say that forfeitures will be used to reduce contributions, but it does not authorize a conflicted fiduciary to choose that when there's a better option in the plan.
And let me just tease this out. You aren't saying that there's any obligation on a settlor, I mean the plan sponsor or anybody like that, to actually build and design a plan that says, yes, one of the options is to offset administrative costs. Are you? You're just saying that once you do that, you have to play by the terms that you wrote.
Correct. And once you do that and you entrust a fiduciary to decide what are we going to do with this bucket of plan money, they have to choose the use that is best for participants. And we plausibly alleged here that they didn't do that because year after year, they used it to reduce their own contributions, more than $30 million.
Now, that's obviously not entirely to the detriment. I mean, I don't know that that's to the detriment of plan participants. That might not be as squarely beneficial or as directly beneficial. You can sit there and say any use of this money to reduce plan contributions might have some benefit to plan participants. For instance, maybe it allows the sponsor to keep the matching contributions at the level that they previously promised year after year if we know we're getting the forfeitures to do it. So it's not devoid of any benefit to the plan participants. You're just saying that there's a much, much, much better benefit, which is take $2 million or whatever the figure is off our administrative expenses.
That's right. I mean, that's exactly what we're saying. The fact that the forfeitures could be used to reduce the contributions might, you know, benefit some participants in some circumstances. The Department of Labor has speculated as to some. If the fiduciary is made aware that the settlor is not going to be able to make or refuses to comply with its contribution obligation, or the settlor tells the fiduciary, we are going to amend the complaint and eliminate, you know, our contribution obligation altogether if you allocate the forfeitures toward paying expenses. Those are facts that are not in this record that DOL is suggesting could justify what Siemens did. And we agree. We just need to get to discovery to determine why the decision makers decided to use these forfeitures for that purpose. And we think this case is controlled by Struble, because in Struble, this court had, there's fiduciary defendants who had, there were surplus assets in the plan, and the issue is what to do with them. And the employer trustees decided to use those surplus assets to reduce the contributions the employers owed to the plan. The district court dismissed, or I think it was on summary judgment, the case in favor of defendant. This court reversed, saying the standard is, did they act solely in the interest of the participants? They act solely in the interest of participants, undivided loyalty to the participants, and they remanded to determine, we need more fact-finding as what factors did you consider in making this decision?
So to me, this gets a little blurry in terms of duty of loyalty and duty of prudence, because both options are available under the plan, right? You can, one option is reduce administrative costs, the other is apply it towards contributions. It seems strange to me to argue that there's a duty of loyalty problem when you've picked one of the acceptable options. You've done what the plan allows you to do. It's weird to say, gee, I wasn't loyal to the plan when I picked one of the available options under the plan. doesn't that blur more into a prudence issue of like, yes, you're loyal, you're following the plan, you're picking an option, but when you pick an option, you have to be prudent about the one you pick. Loyalty seems that, you know what, I did something that just, you know, forget the terms of the plan, forget benefits, I'm doing my own thing. Isn't this more of a prudence issue than a loyalty issue?
I think it's both, because there's a loyalty issue here, because the employer has a conflict of interest. They can either reduce their own contributions, which they have an incentive to do, and in fact, they did every year by the tune of $30 million, or they could give this benefit to participants and reduce the expenses that are charged to their account. So that is a disloyal decision if what we allege.
It's kind of a strange disloyal decision, though, because they wrote the plan in a way that was already very favorable to the plan participants by allowing it to be an offset. But I guess you're saying that once that happens, then you have to consider that option.
Well, yeah, under this court's precedence, once the fiduciary has discretion to do something, they must exercise that discretion with an eye single to the participants' interests. And that's what we're alleging they didn't do here. I agree there's also a prudence issue, though. My time is up. Does any other questions?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why I'm trying to get to more of the threshold thing, which is finding the match between the benefits after the vesting time expires and they were forfeited and the fiduciary responsibility. Because if definitionally those benefits were not initially given to the other participants, they were given to the would-be participant who left before the vesting. So I'm just not sure that you've actually argued successfully yet with how the fiduciary duty of loyalty and prudence that was then forfeited, the benefits forfeited, attaches somehow to a duty to the other participants who had no involvement initially and were never promised those initial benefits for the departing employees who had never vested.
Because the promise is in the reallocation provision of the forfeitures. They have two options. And the promise is, ERISA requires you to pick the option that is best for participants.
But that's, I think, what my colleague's pressing you on, which is, and this might be like a tautological semantics problem. He's asking, it sounds like, well, if that's an option, it's like your position is to use that one option always violates the duty of loyalty and prudence, because by definition, there's a conflict of interest and the employer would always pick something in their benefit. And I think I'm saying that's because it's those benefits that were not vested were never clearly something to which the other employees were entitled. So they're just not subject to the same fiduciary duty as the allocation of the benefits that were part of the guaranteed plan.
I just like to say, we're not saying that in every case, forfeitures must be used to pay expenses. Just saying the Department of Labor has identified two situations where maybe it would be in the best interest to use forfeitures to offset contributions. So I just want to make that clear. We're saying on these facts, where we allege there was no risks of underfunding, that on these facts, the best use would be to pay the expenses. Now, the fiduciary duties attach to the plan assets. Once the fiduciary has a duty to distribute plan assets in the best use of participants, it doesn't matter if it's a participant that is gone and now is left, they remain plan assets, they don't leave the plan. And they have to redistribute those assets in the participant's best interest as a whole. We're not looking at just the participant who was promised a matching contribution, but then forfeited that. We're talking about the money that's in the plan with left over, what to do with that. And the way ERISA defines fiduciary is that it's fiduciary duties attached to plan assets. And these are indisputably plan assets. I'm sorry, I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. We'll see you back in the
day. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Josh Yah for Appalee Siemens Corporation. There's a reason that two dozen district courts have rejected claims like Mr. Kane's, and there's a reason that the Department of Labor supports those rulings. ERISA's text, history, purposes, regulation, and case law foreclose such claims. Together, those authorities refute Mr. Kane's notion that a plan administrator breaches fiduciary duties and engages in self-dealing under ERISA by merely exercising plan-conferred discretion to use employer contributions forfeited by former employees to cover employer contributions for current employees. And that is far from the only reason for affirmance. Among other fatal defects for Mr. Klein's claims is that the Siemens plan gives the committees administering the plan no discretion to use forfeitures to pay the so-called asset-based administrative expenses that Mr. Kane says should have been paid with forfeitures. In short, Mr. Kane's suit was properly dismissed. I'd like to start with Mr. Kane's fiduciary duty claims.
Wait, let's start with a hypothetical. In a situation where Siemens was the sponsor or settler and not the administrator, would your position remain the same, that the administrator was not responsible for or did not have a fiduciary duty to use the forfeited amounts to benefit the participants, to maximize the benefit of the participants?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is the situation here. Siemens is not the fiduciary. The fiduciary are the committees. If you look at the
committee that's associated with Siemens, right?
It is a committee that is made up of Siemens employees.
Okay, so I guess in the scenario where the fiduciary was truly separate and didn't have any overlap of interests with the sponsor, would your answer be the same?
The fiduciary, if all the other facts were the same, the fiduciary would not have a duty to use forfeited employer contributions to cover administrative expenses in the way that Mr. Kane.
But you can see how, in theory at least, you know, the one expects that when a fiduciary has discretion to make a decision under a plan, it is expected to make the decision that most highly benefits plan participants, right?
In some circumstances, that can be the case. But in the circumstances that are present in this case, the use of forfeitures is entirely appropriate. You have a situation where Congress and regulators have long approved the use of forfeitures for employer contributions.
The plan could have said these forfeitures will be used for employer contributions. Like, I don't think anyone disputes that. But I think the question is really as a general matter, doesn't the fiduciary need to maximize the benefit of its choices for the benefit of participants?
No, Your Honor. There are cases like Wright and Rozo and Foltz that say there is no exclusive duty to maximize pecuniary benefits to participants.
Pecuniary benefits because there could be other non-pecuniary benefits?
My understanding is that the pecuniary benefits are the benefits that matter for purposes of fiduciary duty under the Fifth Third case.
Okay. So do you see any aspect of a conflict of interest here in the identities of the settler and the fiduciary?
Your Honor, at most there could potentially be a potential conflict, but as we know from the case law, a potential conflict alone does not state a breach of fiduciary duty claim.
Why did the other circumstances, what other courts and other regulations have done, matter? Your brief at times and other briefs tell us that this is always an individual circumstance dependent scenario. And so it feels strange to me to then go look at other plans with other plan provisions and say, oh, they used it for contributions. We can use it. But they didn't have not all of those contemplated administrative costs as an option, and yours does. So don't you think that those have, dramatically reduced relevance as background principles if they don't match up to these individual circumstances?
Sure. If the plan directed that forfeitures be used only for employer contributions, those types of situations would have less relevance. But there are plenty of employers out there, as we know from the wave of litigation that's been filed over these kinds of plans, that do have a choice between using forfeitures for either employer contributions and administrative expenses. And the fact that so many employers and fiduciaries in those circumstances choose to use the forfeitures for employer contributions is one of the factors that supports the prudence of what the committee did here.
But why? I mean, this isn't in the record, and we're so early in the process, but, you know, in terms of the arc of the litigation, but I'm really struggling, like, why would a plan sponsor design a plan that includes the administrative costs or administrative expenses provision? Just why? It seems like I don't know why you would ever put that in, because it strikes me that that's almost always going to be the best option for the pecuniary interests of the plan participants. And so when you put that in, you're kind of stacking the deck. You know, it's almost like, why would do you have any idea? Or if you don't want to say, I understand, we're really early, but I just don't understand why you would put that in if you weren't having a corresponding duty or a corresponding understanding that, yeah, that's probably option 1A for us, because that's best for the participants.
Well, I can tell you, I can give you two answers to that. First, for 50 some years, plans have had this option. The regulators in Congress have said it's okay to have the option. And so plans put it into their, or employers put it into their plans. The second reason I can say is that, you know, at least for Siemens, you know, the way that expenses are incurred is not on a smooth curve. So sometimes expenses will come in faster than the monthly charges intended to cover those expenses. And so this was designed to give a little flexibility so that if in January, the record keeper expenses exceeded the amount that had already been collected on a monthly basis from plan participants, the plan could use forfeitures in January to cover those excess expenses. So that's an explanation for why an employer would do it. But I think, you know, sort of the broader point is employers didn't put this in here to trap themselves, right? Employers control the language of these plans. And no employer thought by putting this in there that they were actually giving their fiduciaries a false choice.
I believe you. I think that's right. But I mean, I have no reason to doubt that. But at the same time, once you put it in, it stands out to me as option 1A. Like, it's obviously the best option. I mean, just as a matter of intuition, if you can have or significantly offset participants' administrative cost for their investment, that's a huge savings to them. And so once you put it in, it strikes me that it's really hard. I don't know why it's in there. You said you gave a kind of reason, a little bit of administrative flexibility, but it's hard not to think that it's not the best option for the participants, at least on a motion to dismiss and plausible allegations.
Let me try to give you two reasons why it is not the best option. One is the point that the Department of Labor has made, which is that you have to consider how a sponsor is going to react to a situation where they're forced to pay these administrative expenses that they never expected. And so they could try to recoup them in the next year. They could change the plan to reduce contributions in the future.
I read that in the Department of Labor's brief. Like, I don't know. That's not particularly persuasive to me, because I think one of the reasons that you include matching contributions isn't necessarily to run a cheap and efficient plan, but it's to attract talent. And so if Siemens says, hey, you know what, we're going to do away with our matching contributions, you know, good luck getting the Caltech grads that you want to work for you. They're going to go to your competitor that has better matching contributions. So I read that, but I didn't think that appreciated kind of the real reason that people put matching contributions in. It's to attract and retain talent. And so, yeah, it might be a snafu for plan administration, but you might just have to eat that to keep the talent you want, no?
Well, I think that employers are balancing the need to attract talent and the cost of these plans. And so they set the contribution levels on the understanding that the administrator has the discretion to apply forfeitures to cover the employer contributions. And if that option is no longer there, employer is going to reconsider the contribution level.
But I don't think that the alternative is that there's no longer an option to apply forfeitures to employer contributions. I think the alternative is that, you know, a company in Siemens' position writes a plan that says these forfeitures will always go toward employer contributions. And then elsewhere in the plan says something like, you know, the settler may from time to time when it sees fit, you know, make additional contributions to cover administrative fees or something, right? Instead of giving it, but putting in one provision, a choice to either financially benefit the sponsor or financially benefit the participants is the problem in that one provision.
Well, yeah, what I would say is, you know, if the upshot of this is that every plan is going to now rewrite their plan, you know, what's really being accomplished? And is this really to the benefit of participants to have every plan sponsor now rewrite their plan so that forfeitures can never be used for administrative expenses?
I mean, I don't know that contract interpretation is about like what the ultimate benefit to participants should be, right? I mean, we're supposed to be interpreting the words that are on the page that you said, you know, Siemens chose to put on the page and it happened to not get challenged for 50 years and similar contracts. But isn't that the number one task to see if this is compliant with ERISA?
I think in terms of contract interpretation is to understand the intent of the parties and you know, understanding the history and what Congress has said helps to inform what the intent of the parties is. And another thing that helps to inform the intent of the parties here, and I should say is particularly to the Siemens case, is the fact that the kind of administrative expenses that Mr. Kane wants to have paid are so-called asset-based administrative expenses, which is really a misnomer. What he's really after are the payment of expense ratios, which are sort of internal to the investment options that are available to plan participants. And under the terms of the plan, those simply are not considered the kind of plan administrative expenses that under Article 12, the plan fiduciary even has the option to use forfeitures to pay.
But I guess I'm trying to follow through. Are you saying that the choice that is written into the contract is something that the sponsor is not able to pay for, like if those administrative fees?
So there are some administrative expenses that the committees have the option to use forfeitures to pay, but those are plan administrative expenses. So those are expenses that are incurred on a plan-wide basis by the committees and others who are helping to administer the plan, record-keeping fees. The kind of expenses that Mr. Kane once paid are completely different from that. They are expense ratios that are attached to the particular investment option. So if you invested in, let's say, a Fidelity mutual fund, right, there's an expense ratio that's embedded in the price of that mutual fund. That's completely different than a plan administrative expense. And so in this circumstance, the committees thus did not have discretion to use forfeitures to pay the kind of expenses that Mr. Kane says that they should have paid.
I guess Mr. Kane's counsel can clarify, but my understanding was that he's saying that the fiduciary has to make the choice that best benefits the participants and among the two options that are given in the contract. And so if you're saying that only a certain class of administrative fees are coverable, then those would be the only ones that are eligible regardless of any arguments Mr. Kane makes to the contrary, right?
Yes, that's what we're saying is that you know, even if you were to conclude that they had to use the forfeitures for the administrative expenses that the plan allowed them to pay, that still wouldn't allow Mr. Kane's claim to go forward because he wants the plan to have paid expenses that the plan does not allow the fiduciary to use forfeitures for.
One last question. Your opposing counsel says everyone agrees that forfeitures are plan assets. I think that was maybe one of his opening lines. When someone says that, I just like to check in and make sure that, yes, in fact, everyone does or does not agree with that. Do you agree that forfeitures are plan assets?
We have not contested that for purposes of this appeal, but to go to the question that Judge Mascott was asking, on page 51 of our brief, we do make the point that fiduciary duties often and perhaps in this case should not attach to unvested benefits.
So can you develop that for us a little bit? Why not?
Well, because they are unvested benefits, they're not promised to any participant. And because they're not promised to any participant under the plan, the duties of the fiduciary are far less in terms of directing them towards particular uses.
If a fiduciary just wanted to self-deal out of those and say, you know what, we're all going to Disneyland, that would still be a problem, right?
Yes, that would be a problem. There are many provisions in ERISA that prevent plan fiduciaries from taking plan assets and putting them straight into their own pocket. And of course, that is not what is alleged here, and that is not what happened here. We're guided by what the plan promises, and as Judge Mosca pointed out, the plan here promises to participants a certain level of employer contributions. And everyone agrees that the participants receive every dime of the employer contributions that they were entitled to under the plan.
So I'm sorry, just to keep going on the whole attachment of fiduciary duties. So you said fiduciary duties do not attach to the non-vested assets. So what would be preventing those from going to Disney World, like my colleague asked about, or other ERISA protections and obligations? So I guess that's my question to you, if that's your position. And then my second follow-up thing is, when we're talking about to whom the fiduciary duties attach or protect, is it the participants just generally, or participants like person by person? And do the departing employees, do the benefits that at one time, you know, were promised to them but never vested, are those actually part of the participant asset? So I just want to understand a little bit more the relationship, again, of fiduciary duty, if it's like person by person or if it's participants as a whole. Because I think that your counsel on the opposing side says plan as a whole, there's this big pot. Once anything's thrown into the pot, it doesn't matter if it doesn't vest or what happens, it's part of this pot. And therefore, it cannot be that it's always in the best interest of the plan for the employer to put it towards administrative fees. So I'm curious, like, your response to that argument.
Right. So to take that in pieces, I would say, and if I said this incorrectly when I first spoke, I apologize. It's not that there's no fiduciary duty with respect to unvested benefits. As Judge Phipps mentioned, you know, there are fiduciary duties. What I'm saying is that the fiduciary duties are more limited in the sense that they don't require that those unvested benefits, you know, be directed in ways not specified in the plan. And so, you know, that's my point on the
fiduciary. You're saying that's because the other participants never thought they had entitlement to that extra windfall in the first place. So it can't be that there's fiduciary duty to that, because there's no guarantee. It's all dependent on the choice of the other employees, whether they stay or leave.
Yes, I think that's right, if I'm following you correctly, Your Honor. The only promise to plan participants, continuing plan participants, is the promise to contribute 6% or whatever the plan says in terms of employer contributions. And as everyone agrees, that happened here. Now, some of those came from forfeited employer contributions from departed employees, but that's perfectly permissible under the plan.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Weinberg.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Edward Wanger on behalf of the United States Acting Secretary of Labor and urging the court to affirm the district court's dismissal. As ERISA steward, the department has a profound interest. Any time a quickly spreading legal theory threatens ERISA's carefully calibrated balance of interests, and we respectfully submit that the question presented here fits that bill. The balance is between ensuring fair and prompt enforcement of rights under a plan and the encouragement of the creation of plans themselves. every pensioner enjoys the protection of fiduciary duties, the highest imposed by law for every time that those duties apply. They're as deep as any recognized, but they are not so wide that they bind fiduciaries to maximize the pensioner's pecuniary interest beyond what the plan documents would promise. The theory advanced by plaintiffs, from what we understand, boils down to the following. The plan offers the administrator's discretion to use forfeit funds either to offset employer contributions or to offset administrative costs to the pensioners. The plaintiffs are not happy with the way in which that discretion has been exercised. Therefore, in their view, a plausible claim for fiduciary duty breach has arisen. There are three fundamental and fatal flaws with that theory. The first is that it's premised on a contortion of fiduciary duties written to section 1104 of ERISA. That provision says that fiduciaries must discharge their duties solely in the interest of participants and for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits to participants and beneficiaries. The Department of Labor, our position is, so long as the fiduciary has made sure that the participants and beneficiaries get the benefits that they are promised under the plan documents, there is no fiduciary duty to go further than that.
I guess I'm struggling with that argument. So if we had a different fiduciary choice, like how to invest plan assets, and if the fiduciary said I could either invest in this very, you know, high yield investment product that would get the participants more money, or I could invest in a low yield one that would get them less money. And if the participants complained about that choice, would that be a viable claim under ERISA?
The answer is it would be a stronger claim. There's a lot of facts that go into that and some of which we're litigating in other cases. But the upshot, though, is in the circumstances that you described, Ms. Freeman, the fiduciary duty under the plan documents, as you've hypothesized, would be to maximize the amount of return on the investments that are in there. That's what a promise under those plan documents would be. The difference in this case, though, is that the promise here under these plan documents is not that these pensioners will get the offset. As a matter of fact, from what we understand, the plan documents in this case and also the one to follow would say that those administrative costs are to be borne by the pensioners themselves. So the decision, the discretionary decision to use these offsets, is use these funds to offset those administrative costs, is going above and beyond what the pensioners are entitled to under those plan documents.
You're saying the fiduciary duty is to make the 6% entitled benefits grow,
mm-hmm.
not to make a decision later to add to those benefits from the windfall of departing employees who we don't know they're going to depart.
That is precisely correct, Ms. Mascott. And that's the way that the Supreme Court has articulated that this basically whenever the fiduciary has the obligation under these circumstances to make sure that the benefits that are promised as a matter of contract law are actually given to or maximized. That also separates this case away from the Struble case that I know that the folks on the plaintiff's side have argued. In Struble, from what we understand it, there were funds that were there were funds that were actually basically extra, but there was no suggestion in the plan documents that those funds be used in one direction versus another.
Okay.
Here, though, the important thing is it's a matter of settler discretion, which the Department of Labor wants employers to be able to use. The settler gave the plan fiduciaries discretion to decide whether or not to give their employees that offset. So that goes to a second fundamental flaw, pardon me, with the plaintiff's theory, in that their theory supposes that
You can take a second, and I think your friend at the table is going to give you some water.
Thank you. Is that what it supposes is that a fiduciary duty can alter or amend a settler decision. The settler decision to actually determine how those particular funds are going to be used was done in a way where no fiduciary duties would command to be used in one or the other. And Judge Freeman, your point as to the fact that these plans could have been written very differently in a way that would have actually wiped this case out entirely really sort of proves that point. The discretion that was written in is a matter of settler discretion. Plaintiff's theory supposes that their fiduciary duties can overcome that and that discretion can only be exercised, pardon me, with the exception of very extreme circumstances, in one direction only.
Ask you just a question. If you know, due to the proliferation of lawsuits like this one, are sponsors changing plans such that this particular aspect of discretion is removed?
As a factual matter, Judge Freeman, I really can't speak exactly to that. What I would direct court to amicus briefs that were filed by the United States Chamber of Commerce and my folks, my friends who are on
I understood the department's brief and also, sorry, the secretary's brief and the other amicus briefs to be saying, well, these plans are going to go away altogether. And it seems that there are much more modest adjustments to the plans that could take place rather than just, you know, stopping providing benefits at all.
Well, there certainly are more modest ones, but we would submit that actually doesn't benefit the American worker. The notion or the option to actually give these offsets to the workers, that fundamentally benefits the pensioners themselves. Just because they haven't realized that offset yet doesn't mean that employers around the country have actually written in that option to benefit those folks. So to the extent that employers are going to at least take that modest step, that still does a disservice to the folks who might otherwise be getting a break from some of their administrative costs.
I guess if the theory is that the fiduciary can decide to give the plaintiffs a windfall from forfeitures from time to time as it sees fit, why couldn't that be put in the plan elsewhere?
We would submit that as it's written, the option, the discretion in there gets to the point that you're actually suggesting, that the discretion itself, because it doesn't promise the pensioners in this case that they will get the offset, is getting to the same point that you've suggested, Judge Freeman. One other point that I want to make, though, is that the rule itself that will come out of this case is one that will not only apply to the Siemens corporations of the world, it also has to apply to the smaller employers, the ones that actually function a little bit more on the margins. And to the extent that there will be people who are fearful of this type of litigation and decide to either take the modest step of wiping out the discretion or deciding not to match, or deciding not to provide plans at all, that might not affect the folks who are here, but that rule itself will have downstream results on other plans, other folks who can't afford to risk class action litigation of this ilk.
So if I understand, I think your lead point, and I'm just gonna trace it back to you, and then I'm gonna ask you for specifics, but as I understand your lead point, is that when we're looking at the fiduciary duties, when we're trying to find out what those fiduciary duties are, we have to do so in light of the promises of the plan. And so there might be things that the fiduciaries could do that would save people a lot of money, that might be beneficial to people, that might do a lot of things that the participants and beneficiaries would really like. But if that's not part of the plan, the promises of the plan, they can't do that. Maybe they could build an employee parking garage so that people don't have to work as long to work or anything else like this. But that's not, you know, even if that did benefit people, that's not part of the plan promise. And so what I understand your first point is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is we have to look at these duties in light of the plan promise. Is that right?
That's precisely correct, Judge Phipps, is that really what the alpha and omega of these cases really is, what did the plan documents say? And one other point that I'm not sure has come through is that of the Section 1104 fiduciary duties, prudence, loyalty, and the third one is basically have a, you know, a conglomeration of investments. The fourth one is to follow the plan documents. And we would submit that is exactly what happened here whenever Siemens decided to exercise its discretion.
And so I guess the question then becomes, well, what is, you know, in the Siemens case, what is the purpose of the plan documents? Do you have a part of the plan document that you can point to? Because we have those are exhibits at this stage of the proceeding that would say, hey, the purpose of these documents is not to, you know, offset employee expenses or, you know, the expenses, administrative expenses for participants and beneficiaries. It's something more narrow. I've looked a little at the plan. I don't want to say I have a comprehensive knowledge of Siemens ERISA plan, but do you know where that promise of the plan is that you think that is relevant here?
I think that the most relevant part, and from what I understand, this is true of all the forfeiture cases that are percolating, not only in this court, but in the others, is that every single one of them has an obligation in the plan documents that the pensioners themselves, the beneficiaries, are responsible for paying a certain number of administrative costs. There's a second provision there that says, if we have this additional money by way of forfeitures, we as the fiduciary have the discretion to either offset those costs, to give these pensioners a break, or to use it to match contributions. That's kind of the biggest point. And we think fundamentally the point is the plan documents themselves obligate these pensioners to pay these administrative costs in the first instance. That we believe is where you should be looking, Judge Phipps, to see in the plan documents what the actual answer is.
It's just, it's so weird to me though, because I get that. That makes so much sense to me. But then there's this extra line, and the extra line then says the fiduciaries can use it to offset administrative expenses. I'm so curious as to why that's in there. I got an answer from Siemens Counsel, and I understand what that is. It was maybe to offset monthly fluctuations and stuff like this. But once that's in the plan document too, doesn't that begin to change the nature of the promise?
I wouldn't say so, Judge Phipps. I think that it's basically a way to encourage folks to join this plan insofar as in a circumstance the actual plan administrator has given itself discretion to give a break to these pensioners to say, you are obligated to pay these administrative fees. We have extra money, so we're going to decide to use it to benefit you. That's really where this comes down to.
And so if it is just that exercise of discretion, and the claim is that no one really thought about exercising that discretion, they didn't even think to exercise that discretion, they never even contemplated the pros and cons of using it to offset costs, isn't that at least a prudence claim that goes forward?
No, and the reason why is that there's no the biggest sort of evidence, particularly at this age, that the duty of prudence has been violated is that the plan documents were followed to a T. There's no argument, and I believe that there's actually a concession, the plan documents themselves were followed, that these were used in one of two directions. So for that, to the extent that those plan documents were followed, there's nothing more that would suggest that something went wrong, that the objectively reasonable fiduciary in this circumstance would have done something different because, quite frankly, the Siemens Corporation is in this comply with its fiduciary duty to actually follow those plan documents. We would suggest it's prima facie evidence that there's no such violation of duty of prudence.
I think it comes down to defining what the duty of loyalty and prudence are with respect to this decision. It sounds like what you're saying and what your colleague was saying is that the duty of loyalty and prudence, because it's built into the plan to have discretion to choose between administrative costs or giving the windfall to other beneficiaries, that so long as one of those two choices is made, it's consistent with the duty of loyalty and prudence. And because these were not contractually guaranteed benefits to the remaining participants, the separate fiduciary duty to increase and maximize plan benefits for participants doesn't actually attach because these were never contractually guaranteed benefits to the remaining participants.
That's mostly correct, Ms. Masco. What we would say is that the clarification there is no fiduciary duty to, in all circumstances, in every single way, maximize the pecuniary value, the money in the pocket of the pensioners, to the point that you're, to be very precise, the fiduciary duties apply to making sure that the benefits that are promised on the contract are maximized, no more, no less than that. And we would say to you, Judge Mascot, that's actually in the text of ERISA itself. So starting with the statute, it does say the duty of loyalty, fiduciary duty, must discharge solely in the interest of the participants and beneficiaries and for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits to participants and their beneficiaries. The Supreme Court has gone one step further and said that what's promised in the plan documents is what you have a fiduciary duty to protect. And in these cases,
so I'm not sure what part of what I said previously then is inconsistent with that.
We would say that I think that the only thing that the clarification there was, it sounded like you had suggested, Judge Mask, that there's a fiduciary duty separate and apart to maximize pecuniary benefits. And we would say that that's probably a little bit too far in the Supreme Court.
So you're saying there's less than that. I was, to be clear on that, just talking about like walling off these forfeited benefits and going back. If I stay in at best, you're just saying even with those vested benefits, there's not always a duty to maximize the pecuniary value of those benefits.
For those benefits, to the extent, because this is a defined contribution plan, because under those circumstances, what is actually promised in a defined contribution plan is to make sure that those investment decisions that are being made are done in a way to ensure that the match, the investment decisions are benefiting to the extent possible the individual pensioners who have invested in these plans okay. themselves.
And then the extra point though is like the separate windfall benefits, because the plan doesn't guarantee that those go into this other pot, that duty doesn't actually attach to that windfall, which is why the employers would have the discretion to do one of the two options that the plan gives them.
Yes, and okay. we would say, well, it's the nuance there is that there is a duty that applies to that. The duty doesn't force
to the hand of the two.
To pick between, the duty doesn't force to pick between the two. There could be a situation, you know, where the duty could command one direction versus the other. So the hypothetical would be, you know, imagine the exact opposite scenario here. Imagine a small employer who decides that they're always going to use the funds to offset their participants' administrative costs. And if they're not making enough money, that means that they can't actually match the contributions for the other employees.
Okay.
In that case, you actually do have a threat to what is promised under the documents themselves. So the duty of loyalty, duty of prudence does apply, but it doesn't command, to use your words, that the pensioners themselves are gifted a windfall.
Right.
So can I just follow up on this notion that if you have a choice, you know, of option A or option B, and you pick either A or B, then you're free and clear in the fiduciary. You get a pass for breach of fiduciary duty. And I'll pivot. I know ERISA is different, but I'm just going to pivot to old school trust. You have someone with a living trust, and they say, you know what, we're going to put, you know, our grandparent in nursing home A or nursing home B. And the fiduciary goes and looks at it. Nursing home A is cheaper, it's marvelous, and it's wonderful, and it has everything that meets needs. Nursing home B is way more expensive and has all sorts of claims for patient neglect, and it's horrible. And the fiduciary picks B and says, yeah, grandparent, you're going to B. You would say, nope, sorry. We aren't even going to entertain a fiduciary duty of loyalty or prudence or anything else like that, because the options in this trust were A or B, and you pick B, and so we're done. We're just going to wash our hands and walk away. Is it? I know this is different, but at least in that trust setting, would you say that no fiduciary claim whatsoever?
No, Judge Phipps, and the reason the difference is in the setting that you're describing. The fiduciary has an obligation to make sure that the person who has to go in one home or the other is actually taken care of. That's the purpose of the trust. That's promised under the trust. The difference here versus what we're describing in the forfeiture context is that there's no promise to get the windfall. There's no promise to get that additional allocation, the offset. So it really does turn on what is promised. In your hypothetical, the promise is to take care and make sure that we're going to put, you know, someone in a house that's going to be in their best interest across the board. That is what the actual sort of gravamen in the trust would dictate. Here, we keep on coming back to the notion that there's a fiduciary duty to follow the plan documents. The actual plan documents, the way they're set up in discretion, the decision to give that discretion is a settler function. Those plan documents do not promise the offset that plaintiffs are claiming. The duties of prudence and loyalty can't be used to, after the fact, alter those plan documents. That's sort of the fundamental issue, is that as far as the plan documents themselves are concerned, they promise certain things. What the plaintiffs are asking for is something above and beyond that promise. The duty of loyalty can't force the fiduciary to act in its, to exercise its discretion in that one direction only.
I'm sorry for prolonging this, but mm-hmm. what do you think of the role of the cap? Isn't there like a $1.5 million cap in the plan here that says, yeah, the most that you can ever offset in a given year of administrative expenses is $1.5 million? And if there is a cap, doesn't that show that at least contemplated as we begin to think about the promise is that, yeah, you will – that some of this can be used for administrative expenses. We just don't want all of it to be used for that. 1.5 is the cap. And I think 1.5 is the cap, but again, these are ERISA docs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, pardon me, and if you want to sort of to your point, we went sort of full on trust law to go full on contract law. Even if that were the case, it doesn't change the fact that the plan documents don't promise. It might suggest that, yes, if we are feeling particularly, you know, pensioner friendly, we want to make sure that this is used, that there is some, you know, reining in. Perhaps the person who actually drafted these documents wanted to make sure you didn't go too far in the other direction. But it doesn't change the fact at all that the discretion written to these documents does not promise the offset the plaintiffs are asking for, or that they're coming to the federal courts to, you know, make a claim to demand about.
Okay.
I see that I'm well over my time, so I'll.
Thank you very much, Mr. Winger. Mr. Palenko, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Very briefly, the promise that was not provided is the promise to administer the plan in the best interest of the participants. And that means administering the forfeitures provision, which gives the options. That's the promise that and the benefit that the participants here did not receive. I wanted to respond to my colleague had said something about the a prudence claim if you follow the plan document. And I believe that was in response to Judge Fitz's question. That's just contrary to Fifth Third, the Supreme Court's decision in Fifth Third. There was a lawful provision that required, it was an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan, required the fiduciary to invest in the employer's stock. The fiduciary did that, complied with the lawful term. The Supreme Court said unanimously that had stayed a prudence claim because it wasn't in their best interests. And so they say that the duty of prudence trumps the terms of the plan document. As to what administrative expenses of the plan are covered by the plan provision that allows forfeitures to pay them, you know, my colleague says that, well, it only applies to plan-wide expenses. Well, we allege that trustee expenses, which are indisputably plan-wide expenses, are paid through these expense ratios. That's in paragraph 24 of our complaint and page 21 of the appendix. And in addition to that, their distinction they're trying to draw between plan-wide and individual accounts makes no sense, because a defined contribution is nothing more than a collection of individual accounts. And courts have said that an expense to one account is necessarily an expense to the plan. And then finally, my last point, as to the duty to maximize pecuniary benefits, there's a line of case law out there that says that duty is not exclusive. And the operative word there is exclusive. In those cases, they were saying there was a duty to amend the plan to provide greater benefits. And the court said, no, the duty doesn't go that far. The duty must be balanced against other competing duties. And so that we don't have that here, though, because the plan actually allows them to pay the expenses that we said they should have done. So I don't think that line of cases applies here. And then the last point, I don't know of any authority that says there are degrees of fiduciary duties. It's an all or nothing concept. So this thing about, well, you owe some fiduciary duties, but others, depending on whether they're former participants or not, or whether they're, I just don't know where that comes from. It's, you owe a fiduciary duty and they're the same for everybody if it's a fiduciary function. So I'm just not sure where he got that from. Unless there's any other questions, I'll rest.
You know, I just have one question, and maybe it's more appropriately directed at Siemens, but I ask kind of why would you write in this to a plan? You know, why would you write in the administrative expense option to a plan? As I understand it, that wasn't in the prior version of the plan. There's a 2017 version of the plan that actually wrote in the administrative expense part, and then you're suing based on that. Do you have, I'm just curious, you know, again, it's extra record, but do you have a perspective as to why a sponsor would write the ability to pay administrative expenses into the plan? Because you seem to be suggesting that that's always going to be choice 1A for the benefit of the participants and beneficiary. And so why would you write that in if you don't intend to do that?
Well, if you don't intend to do it, I don't know why you would write it in. But if the presumption is that you do at least sometimes intend to do it, they haven't done it here, at least during the class period of our case. But I mean, I think it goes to the point you were talking to earlier, which is, you know, employers don't offer these benefits out of the goodness of their heart. They do it because it's a competitive marketplace out there and they want to attract and retain talent. And that is one way that, oh, here's a promise. We promise to administer this provision in your best interest. And most cases, option 1A is in your best interest. So they are promising to do that. I think that's why they do it.
Otherwise, I'd just be speculating because I don't know. I don't represent the employers, but they don't offer matching contributions to out of the goodness of their heart either. They offer matching contributions because they want to retain and attract talent. So I think that's why.
Okay, thank you very much. This case is submitted.